Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. American painter, printmaker, and sculptor Oliver Lee Jackson has created a complex body of work which masterfully weaves together visual influences ranging from the Renaissance to modernism, with principles of rhythm and improvisation drawn from his study of African cultures and American jazz. Held on September 15, 2019, this conversation between the artist and Harry Cooper, senior curator and head of modern art, marked the last day of the exhibition, Oliver Lee Jackson, Recent Paintings. The exhibition presented some 25 paintings created over the past 15 years, many of which were seen publicly for the first time. Jackson's often large-scale paintings blend figural elements of bodies pointing, kneeling, drawing, and playing instruments with colorful abstract compositions and vigorously worked surfaces. Each painting creates a space and world of its own, captivating viewers and challenging them to spend time with the mesmerizing works.
I'm Harry Cooper, Senior Curator of Modern Art here at the National Gallery, and thank you all for coming. Thank you to Allie Peel for organizing the event with Sarah Battle and Olivia Powers in the booth. And above all, thank you to Oliver Jackson. Thank you, sir. So I just want to thank you for a few things before you start talking, because once he starts talking, I might not get another chance. But really, you've been such a pleasure to work with over the years. We've known each other a long time now, but for this show in particular, you didn't give me any difficulties. And but seriously, for lending a lot of the work, the recent work out of your studio, And for coming here several times over the course of these 6 months. It's really been a sort of ongoing, rolling event. How many people, by the way, have seen the exhibition? Okay, great. How many people have been to a gallery talk? Okay, wow. How many people have been to a gallery talk at which the artist happened to be present? Okay, wonderful, wonderful. I will take you back to 1965 here. And I know that you don't want to go into any great biographical detail, so we'll just say that you were 30 years old at this point, born in St. Louis, and then by this time you had your education, had a stint in the Army, And where are we here?
After the Army, back to St. Louis, family, and trying to figure out how to do what I wanted to do. I was unclear on how to proceed in making what people call art. Painting, for me, is nouns, painting, sculpture, things like that. But not knowing how to do it directly, not just knowing the way to negotiate. There were not many means in St. Louis, but the Black Artists Group, that we'll talk about later, there was groups of people that were also makers, musicians. And that we came together to reinforce each other as we were developing how to make our way doing what we wanted to do. It's difficult. That part was difficult. But I had great friends. Some of them are here now, and Suggs, and just really wonderful people. I realize now how close and how much they helped me. And in helping me, I was authentic for them. Let's put it like that. I'm not talking about art now. We're talking about reinforcement as a human being. I was simply authentic for them, see? And that made all the difference. It gives you a kind of security in a desert, so to speak. Where you're not getting reinforcement from the context of larger St. Louis and what it could have had to offer, right? But these people, Tommy Richards, so many people, you know, that I knew reinforce just your existence. And it gives you a lot of strength to carry on when you don't know quite how to be efficient in carrying on. And at that time, I was very, very angry about a lot of things. And it was legitimate anger, but it had my bias to it. So a little bit over the top, you know what I mean? A little bit over the top. But I wasn't alone at that time in being angry. It was a time for anger and activity. The 60s, just terrible in the demands, but they were wonderful demands. They required a lot. You had to be up to it. And the only way you were up to it is you had to get right, or like Aretha Franklin said, you couldn't do it conceptually. You had to get into it and suffer what you brought to bear. You had to suffer it, you know, and that was payment for every bit of anger that I have. That's fair, too, if you understand. Carry on. That's enough of that.
Well,
that.
No, it isn't really. We've got an hour, but I know you've told me your life could have gone a lot of different ways, good and bad and ugly, and you, we were just talking about music and your passing attempts at the piano, and then finding art. Which seems to have been a kind of salvation.
I didn't know what art was. I was small. I use that term now because I'm sophisticated. Sophisticated person.
I will be corrected several times because there's a number of words that we're not supposed to use, and art happens to be one of them. But
the reason. Remember, I was an art instructor, so I know a lot about art. Art is an evaluation by somebody else of what has been made. They make that decision. When I use the word artist, it means to me making something. I make things. The term artist has got a lot to do with some kind of designation as a special being. Lots of people make things. I make these kinds of things, and people recognize it, and so you're called an artist. You have to be careful with the term. The real thing that's interesting to me is, am I a good maker? See? See, the public chooses for many other reasons. I have to know personally, alone, while I'm making this, is this made well and right? Not according to their rules. According to my inner rules. So that takes a lot to have confidence in that, to know the rightness that comes from within. Everybody out here has got rightness for art. Well, art is like this, it should be like that, it should be abstract expression, it should be abstract, it should be this, it should be a lot of names. I'm just messing with some paint, some canvas, some stone, and I know I have intention, I want something, and I've got to find it. I can't depend on art. I can depend on good training, craftsmanship, but more than that, I've got to depend on my sensibility. Do I have the courage for it? That's the clue. That's on me. That ain't art.
So I will ask you, you make a lot of things. You make studio equipment, you make shelves, you make things. Those are different from what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So what is the difference?
Oh, well, it's like this table. It's not meant to move you. It's meant to serve you. Hopefully that work up there is meant to move you in here. That's its only purpose. And it's a contemplative act on your part, and it's a making action on my part. These works, for as far as I'm concerned, are you, the spectator, and I'm a spectator after I finish. I'm also a spectator. I don't need to do anything but use these eyes. This is a language for the eyes, you see? But it requires to have something for the eyes. I have to make something, and I have to make it appropriately or in the way that I see it. It's on me. Then it's for you. Any eyes, no matter where I'm coming from, and I do mean in a society like this, it's so goddamn concerned with race and who it's for. Eyeballs don't care. Anybody's eyes at any time. They come to their conclusions. That's cool with me. But I have intentions, and I try my best to speak clearly in the language. I mean clear, you know. In other words, if this mark is beside this mark, I intended that, and I hope they have the effect visually that it resonates you. Literally, that the completed work and everything within it resonates you. That is, shifts you just by vibrational shifts and experience, and it belongs to you. You know? It takes me to make one of them Jacksons, but it took El Greco and El Greco to make what we call an El Greco painting. You know, I'm just an agent in many ways, but I'm an agent with intention. I have purposes, but my purposes are not your experience. You know, I can't control that part of it, and I don't intend to. It's not important to me.
I've been reading the writings of Philip Guston, an artist we both admire, and he talks about the metaphor of a gong, and the painting is like a gong, and if you're tuned to it,
that's right,
you'll vibrate, and very much the kind of language that you've used, and and in many ways,
I always use like a bell. It's like it's just a term to kind of express how you make evaluations of what it is you're actually doing mechanically. So you got a feeling. A feeling's not a painting. A feeling is not an image. But since I'm dealing in images, I must find the images, and the feeling and the image have to go. If the feeling is ding, then the image has to do ding. You know, ding ding, not ding dong. So you'll be doing a lot of ding dongs, and then that's the search, that's the frustration. How do you get? So that's the critique. See, it's like this may look good aesthetically, it may look good quote unquote artistically, but it is not correct because it's not doing ding ding. So that's the if we want to call it a struggle, that sounds too heroic, too Greek. You know, like you got a heroic struggle. It's something I want to do. So I don't like the terms you're struggling. It's what I want to do. It is difficult, but I like it, so it's not a struggle in that sense. So I don't want to be too pompous about it. I like to be pompous about other things, but, you know, not that, you know. But the point is this, that once I understood, it took a while, I had to mature into it, the demands of making from feeling, the feeling makes demands. It is not driven by the concept of pleasure and aesthetics. The feeling says, this mark it correlates. So it's a ding, ding, it's not ding, dong. So if I get the dong, I got to find it. I got to move the dong out of the way, get to the ding, if you're following me. So that makes the making process very, very critical. You know, it's kind of critical. It's not about art. It's like, that ain't right. That ain't right. Now, then I have to find it. I don't have the answer right away, but I don't mind searching for it.
Okay. The philosophy of ding dong. And
careful with the dong, ding dong.
So
used in nefarious places.
I'm going to go back to the history a little bit. So as you said, you were an angry young black man in a racist city. It's fair
to say. A lot
of
angry young white people, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they were angry with me. I'm angry with them. Okay. This is America.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. God bless
we're angry
it.
With each other.
Yeah. But you mentioned the black artist group. How many people were here? Probably not too many for the films yesterday. Okay, where we had a documentary about the black artist group, and then one of the films that was a product of that multi-arts group in St. Louis, which you were closely
associated
involved
with.
You want to say a few words about that before we get into maybe the Sharpeville paintings?
Well, it was, when I said that whole angry thing, it was a time, it was a great deal of anger, period, legitimate, like I said. And then there was a necessity that arose throughout the United States among African-American people to take into their own hands to remedy these incredible difficulties that they're facing. And the United States is incredibly hostile to African-American people in its total history, and that's right till now. And it's an everyday thing, and the nuances of it are deep, and abiding, let us say. And there are times, and there are obvious times when it's too much. And then you have to take into your hands, regardless of your resources, you cannot suffer it spiritually. And that's why you move against it. And your anger is good, but proper, but you're not necessarily clear in how you use it. But we were clear about we had to do something for the African-American community. It was a desert. The young people needed something. So what we had to give was training in music and poetry and theater and those things we could do. And so that's the origin of the coming together. We felt a strong need. And in that sense, it was militant, not in the political militant sense. We were doing that. That was politics. But this was the militancy of having to serve to help young people find their capacities reinforced by training. There was no training in the public schools. They were all being wrecked and torn apart. Everything was being downgraded, no money, etc., particularly among African-American people. And so the young people hungry for something, and we could provide it as much as we did. We did. I'm proud of that.
Yeah. Well, what we learned yesterday was remarkable, that classes were set up in the Pruitt-Igoe, notorious, nefarious former housing projects, and weekly performances, just an incredible level of productivity. But also at the same time that you were teaching, you were sort of in a parallel way, just making art and collaborating with these great figures like Julius Hemphill and others, right?
Yeah, it was, if I really want to get this straight, if I remember it well, it was not just people who made music or made poetry. It was also the professional. They were our age, Suggs. And we all had the same feeling, we've got to do something to, in this barren landscape, to make sure that a generation of people who had these capacities had some kind of training, some kind of legitimate training. We knew some things. We had a training ourselves. That we were professionals in that sense. I was teaching at that point, I think, either part-time at Washington University. So I was teaching to making other people professional. I was a half-assed professor there, right? So I had the skills for that. But in this desert for African-Americans, nobody was there. All the facilities had been torn apart, and we stepped up. And so it was not just, I want to be clear about it. It was, for instance, doctors, lawyers, we were all generally in the same age, who really put money and energy into making this happen for us, right? It was real interesting. I mean, I'm recalling a bit of it, and I wish I could to say everybody's names that were involved, not just the Julius Hemphills or Julia or Malinke. These were the people involved in actual training, but the people that helped us buy equipment, put money in, put on programs. We had to make, we did everything, you know, make the posters, write up, buy instruments, and it was great though. Mm-hmm. It was great. And then at the same time, this is all true, we're working politically and hardcore politics in terms of there was a war going on, there was a race war going on at the time in Indiana. We were reinforcing, putting funds together for that. In St. Louis itself, the argument up against African-Americans with the police force, just like Ferguson, just the same thing. They were coming down on us. That was everyday stuff. It wasn't just for bag. It was all the political push and pull at the time. It was fierce stuff, you know. We were young and dumb and up to it. Up to it, you know. That's so really...
Yeah.
And I'm too old now, but I still like to talk about it. I could do that again.
Well, I actually...
You could do something. It's just...
I haven't actually gotten you to talk about it before, so that's... great. And then Bag has a limited life, and some of the funding is withdrawn when there's a sense that maybe things are getting a little.
Well, they were so political. See, from the top down, we started to be scrutinized. As it's always interesting. It was just this was all aesthetics and art. But because whenever African-American people train and teach each other, the suspect is that they're in revolutionary mode. No, they were teaching poetry and all that, but we were being scrutinized by FBI, CIA, literally as a militant organization. Our militancy was actually when we participated in real politics on the streets, not teaching, but real what was then considered subversive. I better watch myself, Homeland Security. Washington, D.C., you know. The point is that it is a complex time, very dynamic. And so we're acting on many fronts like many people were. I mentioned certain people, doctors. They're doing doctoring, they're legitimate doctoring, but they're all doctoring, but they're also involved in political activity that is anti, at this time, establishment, because the establishment was against us. Yeah. And so we're against it too. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. So, but all I'm trying to express is that was, it was always conflated by the authorities, and we were scrutinized, and there were files kept on, so all that's true. But they misread, that was not the place, that was just about painting and dancing.
But they didn't know what you were
up to.
Really up to. So let's talk about some of the painting that happens right after that, and one of the first major series is titled Sharpeville. I think about 8 paintings from the early 70s. And tell us a little about, so this is a place where, somewhat unusually for you, the there's a political connotation right in the title.
Absolutely. At this time in South Africa, the same thing is going on. The world is hot in this kind of thing. And in South Africa, the beginning of the end of apartheid in a particular way, you know, overt apartheid is being challenged. And eventually, of course, we know what happened. But I had been to Africa before. I had traveled in Europe. I had done all this. These things prior to Bag. I understood some wonderful things going back to the old country for me. I'd been to Europe before, loved it, etc., but going to Africa was intensely important to grasp what we are when not interfered with by white culture. And it was marvelous to see it, you know. It wasn't like it was pristine. It's not like Black Panther. It wasn't cosmetic like that, you know. Yeah. I like Black Panther now. That cosmetic shit's okay. Don't get me wrong. And we need it. But the point is, what I wanted to know about me is to see me without a context that was against my reality. It's simple, right? And I learned so much just to see the psychological burden that is a part of having to live in this country. And that burden is real. It's not superficial because the pressures are real. In a country that, even though colonized, it was traditional enough that you could find yourself, just like Europeans going to Europe, not reflected under an oppressive scene. Who am I? How do I act when I'm not under pressure? These kind of ridiculous pressures. And what I saw was a human being. It was in me, but it was bent up. And I saw myself reflected as a person free, just to touch in a way that you couldn't touch each other in this country, to hear, to see, and to enjoy reality without looking over your shoulders under threat. And I mean that seriously. That was wonderful. So then I could see my work better. I could clear myself of the madness that comes upon you in the United States for everybody. I'm sure it's for whites too, but they don't talk about it. You know what the hell. The point is this. So then I could address my capacities and be cautioned in acting so that I could monitor the diff. How can I say it? I could clear myself of my own prejudices that got in the way of the use of my capacities. That makes sense.
Yes, perspective on this
work
situation
had to do with choosing the struggle in South Africa rather than at the same time the one here, because they are almost identical. I would be clearer and less biased in looking at that than I would in presenting the one that was here, because I was too close to it. Do you follow what I mean? Because the one in South Africa clears the bell. And so I could see more clearly what was at stake, the economic basis of it all, who, you know, that kind of thing, clearly, rather than the personal stroke across the back, which is personal. To be personally whipped goes down the family, and it clouds your eyes to the larger picture that causes that to happen. Mm-hmm. See, that's the reason you get whipped, is that we got to make money. And you cannot remember, okay, so that becomes personal, and you forget what the larger picture is that does all that. See, it makes you limited. Looking at this, I could see so clearly.
Tell us a little about this.
Well, these were photographs that came from photographs of these running when the people were being shot. Simply mm-hmm. straightforward, just being shot down in Sharpeville. Mm-hmm. If anybody remembers 1971, I believe it was, the massacres, they call them massacres, where apartheid regime was going into the town sites, the young people rising up just like they were in the United States, being dogged and shot at. They were being shot at with bullets and they were being killed. I was removed enough that I could use those images without getting entangled in 400 years of personal anger. I could see it more clearly. And it was a kind of cosmic poetry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was larger than what was really going on. Was a shift cosmically, and I know it sounds weird, but it ain't romantic. There was a shift taking place, and of course it's still taking place in the world right now, an extraordinary shift. And these cruelties and all these things are building to another kind of clarity. We have to make assessments. It's hard to do it when it's too personal. We have to make assessments that we perform now in a way that doesn't bend us up too much for the future to come. We have to be careful. So it was easier to deal with this running away from mm-hmm. the violence. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't Mississippi. See, if I look at Mississippi, my folks from Mississippi, I got a hair up my ass about Mississippi. I'm much more understand the ideal of Soweto, of a people being pursued in this way, that all of a sudden the clarity of this struggle, it becomes a cosmic struggle. We're not talking about the forces of good and evil. We're talking about forces that have objectives that don't suit my humanity. That my struggle is one that spiritually I'm not having this. I want to be clear about that. I don't want to get too personal about boss and masters and slaves, too personal. I want to know what my spirit cannot bear, so I'm not trapped in the psychology of master and slave. It's very important. And therefore, I can become, and in this sense, we're not talking religion, clean again, so that I own my purposes in life, and I'm not confused about it. And if there's going to be a coming together, there'll be a willingness. I will understand why I wish to associate or don't wish to associate. It's clear, that's all. Okay? So these images were poetic. They're like a dance, but all violence is like a dance when you isolate it. It just is. Mm. You got to watch the aesthetics too. It's too pretty. You know, what's that film? Yeah. Love War. What's that? What's his? Patton says that. Ooh, I love the smell. Oh, that's in Godfather. Godfather.
Apocalypse Now.
I love the smell of napalm. You know, mm-hmm. That's the beauty in war. You got to be careful mm-hmm. with that one.
Patton was good too.
Yes, exactly. Same thing.
Okay, now, speaking of Africa, I know you've talked about watching makers in Africa and what you learned from that and ideas you developed about what you started to call an African sensibility or African continuum.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about that too, that aspect of Africa.
Well, we had been, prior to me going, I told you the reasons that after the Army, I wanted to go to Africa. I said that I'd been to Europe. I want this to be clear for the audience. Listen, the European cultural thrust, extraordinary. I said the real cultural thrust. I'm not talking about politics now. I'm talking about them Beethovens and them Mozarts and them Michelangelos. Listen, them Cezannes, real deal, spiritual thing. Really, truly, not laden with this nonsense that we have to deal with. It's nonsense, but real. So I'm not putting that. But Africa, I need to know, because it's put down here. This is a culture, European culture, that says we have no history. See, I come up in that. I know better, but I haven't got the concreteness of it. I go to the old country, concrete. What I saw reinforced what I believed. I didn't have to conceptualize, see? I saw makers and the traditions and training that was not in the academy, absolute skills and an understanding of form. Of course, the European great makers saw that right away, but that's a historical denial for the population, right? But listen, so I understood the sensibility that spoke without the dichotomies made in Western art, that any materials could be used together as long as they made the thing come alive that you were after. So they're not categories. So the categories in the West is you can't, at this time, you can't paint marble. It should be white. You don't paint it. See, that's academic. Well, the marble doesn't give a shit. The marble doesn't care. But you can see in the head, it's a pristine concept that somehow that's classic. You follow me? But the Greeks painted it for days, right? But you can see those are the things the academy says you couldn't do. When I go to Africa, you could paint it, you could put cloth there, the wood with cloth, beads, whatever, as long as the thing made moved the person. The whole point was make it right if it needed that. Mud with marble, who cares? The mud and the marble, if they will adhere together, they don't care. So I learned, and it freed me up, to use my sensibility in terms of the world. When I say that, we're always using the world, the stuff of the world. Marble is stuff of the world. It's of the world. To combine it in ways so that the feelings that I had, they were reflected in the sensuality of the piece. So it just opened doors about how to use the sensual world. The world is sensual. How to use it so that my feelings were clear, precise, and rich, right? So that was like freeing up. And then the skill level, surety of hand, and then the love for making. It wasn't, nobody was talking about being an artist, just this is what I do. This is my love. See, the whole thing about art is it makes you too self-conscious about you, and you're not a devotee to what it is that you can do. I'm simply a devotee to this. I'll spend time with it. I have to serve it. Wears you out too. I lose my teeth. You get down to the bone. But this is okay with me. But I'm serious. I'm smiling. My dear friend Julius Hemphill is dying, and in his death time, which took a minute, the last week, he playing music. That's what he did. That's wonderful. I would love to have that kind of courage for work. Michelangelo in his last days is carving. That's your devotee. I don't know why it calls you. And I mean that, and that ain't romance. I don't know why.
Or religion.
Oh, please, with the religion. I didn't say sacred nor holy. They're different things. I didn't say you'd be against the belief in God. I don't know why. I don't know. Everybody know a lot about God. A lot. But they say you don't know anything. They say, nobody knows God. Then they tell you everything about him. Everything about him. He don't like, he'd like this kind of meat, don't like beans. I mean, all over the place, you know.
So speaking of Julius Hemphill, and if you've seen the movie that we made, wonderful movie that Carol Moore and David Hammer made here on our staff, the whole score is music from Julius Hemphill, and this album, just on a personal note, is where I first encountered your art. 1977, I was graduating from high school and bought this album, and the music just changed my life, really. And And that drawing just burned itself into my mind. It became fused with the music. Yes.
And, I love it.
It did. And when I became a curator, I realized that I could actually try to find this artist. I got some help from Marty Ehrlich, who is a wonderful musician who continues Julius Hemphill's legacy. And I knocked on your door, you know, so.
That was interesting, too, indeed.
Yes.
Julius chose that. I did not lead him. We understood that you don't paint music. He makes music. I make visual. And the language he uses is clear as a bell. That's the language, no translations. You either get it or you don't. The same with the visual thing. He was very strong in his visual grasp, and he chose this, not to illustrate his music, but the ambiance was... He understood the ambiance, the same ambiance, not illustration at all. You know, not mimicking this, you know, not trying to in any way in the visual realm to duplicate music, but the same territory. See? Speaking of that, at that time, I knew certain people called Paul Carter Harrison. We all knew each other then. With Julius, we were doing, this is interesting at this time, of doing sets for him. We were arguing and stuff. We just, you know, talking about modality. We're working together. We're working together, Paul and I. And he, can you hear me? Okay. And then we meet. At a similar time, we bring Julius to try to get him a job. Everybody needs money, so we're working in the university. I hate to mention the name because they don't need help. We needed help. But anyway, so we're trying to get black people in a little bit. So we're trying to get all the black people in before the poverty program. There ain't no money. So Paul is there, myself, Julius, and we're working together, and we're exchanging a lot of serious ideas for us around modality. And modality is the contextual aspect of reality that has a particular ambiance, feeling to it, and trying to grasp what that feeling demands of you. The only way I can explain it in a clear way, for those of you who hang out in bars or have, you can walk into a bar and feel whether you should be there or not, just the vibrations. How many understands that? That's the ambiance of the place. It's clear as a bell if you wish it, right? And then you know whether it suits you at a given time. So modality is like that. And this concept, we're all dealing with trying to get a grasp of it. It's very strong in Africa, the grasp of the mode that you're in. And the mode is like the seasons. That's a mode. Summertime is a mode. And within that mode, there are modes and modes and modes. And there's right down to the specific one of how you relate to it, which will determine how you make what you make. In the wintertime, I make differently. I don't have to think about it. It just changes. Dane knows that. Something happens. You're in that mode, and something about fall requires another sensibility operating. It's still you, but you're affected by that context. So context, context, context. And these contexts are interesting in that a season is simultaneously felt personally. It's as hot as hot, makes you take your clothes off, but also spiritually. Changes everything about you. The winter changes the way you think. The tendency for withdrawing and being eternal. They were so mixed. And we're trying to exploit that. And then understand what sensibility, as this season in this place affects us, and I'm an African man. I come from, when I say that, I'm serious. I don't care about all this shit about mixture. My sensibility is not based in the 2,000 years of European tradition. It is based in a way of handling the world that permits me to deal with song, dance, and know that I love certain cadences. It's really simple. It's not complex. It's a sensibility operating so that I would make these kind of choices, rhythmic choices. The Europeans make another. It's not bad or good. It's just, these are the choices. I like it to go like, like that.
And everybody does have rhythm, right? Different rhythm.
Exactly. But rhythm permits this. But this denial, in this country that you have to fight for what you, your sensibility to show itself and not be afraid to let your sensibility operate. That's important.
I'm going to move ahead because we only have so much time, and I've got El Greco and Picasso and Oliver Jackson and all kinds of things. But one very mundane question that I've never asked you, who did the script on that? Do you know?
I believe Julius Hempel did that.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
It is.
It's beautiful, yeah. I didn't think it was you, but it's beautiful, yeah. So we get into
I was in Chicago at that time in these works.
In Chicago, okay, yeah. And you've referred to these paintings as a kind of phase of doing paint people.
Yes. Yeah. The reason is that if you say you're figurative, then again, the Art Academy associates all figuration with a variation from naturalism. Not the case. That's not how I'm thinking. This is ain't no people. These are not people. We're people. See? Those are paint images using references, figurative references. They can use them in any way. So you have the figure, big-headed, no-armed in this particular thing. On that side, the paint doesn't care if I eliminate just a big head form and the kind of body, and then the other one, little figures. That's all. You can do that in paint. So then people will say, well, are you abstracting the human figure? No. Naturalist, no. What the feeling requires, then the figuration tries to suit that ambiance. And so the shifts are made according to that. And so I think I can think clearly using figures, not as clearly using landscape. I can draw it, but I can't transform very well. But figurative, I can just get started and transform, and I want to let it flow. And the idea of paint people is to remind the audience that these are not people. That is paint. Yeah.
And you've reminded audiences of that several times in the gallery when someone will say, "What is that figure doing?" Yeah. But one thing that I like about the term paint people also is that it suggests that paint is the means of construction.
Absolutely.
And when you look at that painting of those figures in a ring, you can see that the paint is applied in such a way that not unlike Cézanne, it is a construction material, and you see very clearly the units and the choices that are being made
with those units.
That's
right.
What I get.
And that's
that.
The making process, see?
Yeah.
I'm just showing you the bone. This is how it's made. I'm not now making the allusion to a reference where I cover up the paint. See, even in Leonardo that's very smooth, it's really the same thing. He's making, however, the paint will do that. See, I'm just saying, look, the paint can construct without making references to naturalism and hiding the bones of construction, you see? It's like modern architecture will show you the structure as the fundamental basis for the building rather than cover it and clad it. So I'm just saying that I prefer that. It's a directness that I want to deal with. I wanted to make sure that the audience understands clearly this is how it's made, and at the same time, the effect overwhelms the making process. Therefore, the effect, if the work is made well, it hides nothing from you as how it comes to be, but you cannot. You have to experience its effects rather than simply how it's constructed. Yeah. See, and they're locked together, so the ambiguity comes forth. And another reality is possible in which you're not referencing the world, but you're stepping into the world that this permits, allows you to enter, mm-hmm. See, by the way it's constructed mm-hmm. and how it resonates you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this particular painting here is in our collection, and I'm so happy about it because it happened to be a painting that I loved and brought to the Harvard Art Museums when I was there, and now given to us by Ann Coase and her husband. And I think into the 80s now, we get into a period where we really see you drawing, and we see the gesture in paint in this very direct, dramatic way. And there's a sort of run of works, sometimes using paint stick, I think. Is that true?
Paint, yeah, there's paint stick and artist oils. Yeah. And they ain't drawings. They're marks.
Okay. Noted.
Saints or not. You know, listen, I'm a stickler. That taught a lot of art. You know, he's right. They're just marks. And these marks are... drawing this is generally speaking, tonal. This ain't tonal. This is a series of colors. White, black marks, some paint, see? The emphasis is not on... That's why I... But you can have it.
We've got it all, anyway, and you cannot have it back.
Well,
and if I say it's drawing, I think it is drawing. But
see,
they always tell you what you're doing.
Oh boy!
You know he don't make you. You
know, see? You know, finally, it's been 25 years, and now it comes to this. Okay, let's just move on to the next one. Okay.
And that's the academy. They're always telling makers what they're really doing. Well, you don't really know what you're doing. You go like, well, you wouldn't have shit to talk about unless I knew something.
Something.
No. Okay.
Now, but there is a drawing. That's a drawing. It even says so. That's a drawing. Yeah. And, One of my favorite drawings where...
Little tiny thing.
Yes, tiny drawing that you live with, and which, you know, I've been attracted to the image of the horn in the work, and that's clear here.
Yes.
But there's, for me, you know, a lot of your work, if I'm not mistaken, is about relationships, connections. Sometimes it's between figurative presences or... between some kind of figure and some kind of object, instrument.
Absolutely.
In this case, I just feel the way the arms are, the horn becomes a part of that figure.
Absolutely.
The arms are embracing it and vice versa. And,
well, you're onto it. It's like the...
I got one right.
Well, not right's not in it. It's you're trying to nail it down a little too tight. What it is the visual image of morphing the figurative with the instrumental so that what I'm intending is that the musician and the instrument are one.
Nice way to say it. Don't tighten it up too much. Yeah. And then on the left, powerful image that was chosen for the cover of an important book by Saidiya Hartman, who was African-American historian. Leading one.
That's quite a large piece. It was part of the
triptych. Yes, it was.
I like that piece.
Another work in our collection, we are very lucky now to have four or five paintings that really move along through your career. This one kindly donated by Wanda and Paul Harrison.
Yes.
And hard to get too much sense of, well, you get more of the scale. That's probably about... It's almost that big, and we've had it up on display, but during this exhibition, it was in storage.
Yeah, and, I remember the selection of that piece when they both were together. Wanda was so forceful about choosing it. It's a tough painting from my perspective, you know, the layered, and the way the structure opens up and closes up, and the figurative thing melds into the field, and it's really tough in that sense, right? It's very demanding. If you were a human being and you tried to walk in this form into that world, you'd be eaten alive, so to speak, by the force of the field, and that she would choose a work that's got that kind of rigor in it was amazing to me, and that they kept it for so long.
For me, when I look at this, I remember being at the Duomo in Parma, where there's a Correggio ceiling, and you look up into it, and these clouds of figures
are,
and here you're right in it.
You're pulled in. That's
it, true. You're up in that.
It's almost a vortex. The more you look at it, it's almost like a vortex that'll keep pulling you in, but it gets tougher as you go in. It doesn't really open up, and it just gets lighter, but it doesn't get spatially open. It's still more intense as you move toward the...
Yeah.
We have an image down here that's the same.
Being sucked down here, So that was the late 90s, and we worked together in 2002 on a small exhibition at Harvard Art Museums where... You came in residence along with Marty Ehrlich, and you made six paintings, and he made a wonderful piece of music that was recorded and then, you know, piped into the gallery here. You can see the speakers up in the corner. So a sort of experiment in 24/7 music and art.
It was a memorial for Julius. Remember, we
the whole thing this. In it was called Duo, and it was in memory of Julius Hemphill.
Right.
Yeah,
that was a interesting, really interesting time. Harvard.
Let's not even go there. Let's not even. You know, the fact that you even let me in the door with the, you know, I wasn't wearing a Harvard tie. Thank God. And there's you and Marty looking quite
like a
happy.
Duo, like a duo.
Like a smiling fools.
Right.
And I love your roller, which was only for the ground layer, right? You weren't not painting with that.
Well,
no,
I have.
You have.
Any uh-huh. Anything will work if it works.
Okay. And
but not in these. Yeah, no.
But you're using it to prime
make the canvases.
Prime
the canvases,
and here
exactly.
We see the workspace is the floor, and that's been something that's true for years in your work, whether it's the floor or now a low table working on.
That's because it's a panel.
Makes sense. But the horizontal is the plane of work for you.
Yeah, it came about in the use of commercial paints because they flow. So if you're painting with them on the vertical, the paint wants to run down, see? And I don't want that running paint. Mm-hmm. I don't like them little paint running. Hey, I don't like the paint running. So then I started to work on the floor to be able to control the application of the commercial paint. Mm-hmm. And then I found that it afforded me a way of seeing and approaching the work from any angle, and therefore it became much more of a dynamic field and not one centralized, vertical, center around the center, mm-hmm. see? And that really worked for me. And so it worked because I could see it clearly. If you couldn't see it clearly, just nonsense, right? So it worked. You know, and it's not like Jackson Pollock. He also had to use that because he was moving so fast. If he were doing it this way, all that stuff would have run. But I'm not sprinkling paint. I'm really painting, so I'm really seeing it differently. Do you understand?
I do. I think more of Mondrian, who also worked flat on a table. He had no practical need to, but it did do something to the field
that
made it more multi. Directional, you
exactly.
could say.
Well, the corners are not. You can approach from a corner. They normally, you're vertical, you're always coming at it like we come at a wall. But if it's on the floor, you can come at a corner. Mm-hmm. And you can read the composition in ways that you can't if it's standing before you. You can't get up in the sky and look down. You understand?
Yeah.
So it allows you to see the dynamics in those places that are normally not available in a clear way when you're standing in front of it. Yeah. See, that every approach, whether it's right in the middle or the center, it's all dynamically viable, right? Yeah. And there's no favoritism, so to speak.
Right. Right. And there's Marty composing.
Right. Yes.
With a beautiful bouquet of colored pencils.
He got that from Julius.
And this is the album that resulted. The long view with a very nice insert of some of the paintings for the exhibition. And you can see a great assortment of musicians, including some BAG members like J.D. Paran. Most of the remaining slides are slides of images from the exhibition, so you've seen a lot of those. These I placed on the outside because I ran out of room on the inside. So they're on the outer walls, but I've come to think of them as two kind of guardian figures, which are fierce paintings that are warding off the evil spirits, but hopefully not warding off the visitors.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. And you go inside to this work, which is really a highlight of the exhibition, and we're hoping and expecting that it will remain here in the collection. So that's, I'll just give you my little quick art history, free association thing with this wonderful painting. First of all, with one of our Matisse cutouts, which we talked about in the movie. I mentioned Matisse, you took my head off. This is an example, I think, of kind of a pseudomorphism, if you will. It sort of looks like it, but it's really, this is not what your work has to do with in particular. Now, you are cutting out, but Matisse was not the only artist who ever cut out, of course. And in fact, Picasso and Braque were really the first artists who brought the cutout, that is the papier-mâché, into art. And so I think that Guernica is actually more apropos in many ways of this great, great triptych. And actually, this was not my idea. Some of the visitors were pointing out that some of these figures with the big profiles reminded them of figures in the triptych or vice versa.
Serendipity.
Okay, I'm just calling it the way someone else saw it. Some visitor, you know. Okay.
That's an extraordinary painting. But that really is.
It is, and he's also got the prone figures. Obviously, there's themes in common. There's rhythm.
Yes.
There's the frieze of figures. Speaking of the frieze of figures, I've had this association for quite a while looking at that great triptych, which is the just some examples of Greek black figure vase painting, where you see tremendous dynamism, gesture, action. You said earlier that something like every dance is violent, or there's a violence in the dance.
Yes.
And I think that sums up in many ways the mix of feelings that we get from this triptych, which are not separate feelings, but they're completely one kind of feeling with different aspects.
And the when you use the term violence in a very bourgeois society like this, it goes, whew, what you mean? Oh yes, this is ridiculous. What you mean by violence is the dynamic. See? The dynamic, it's like when we were listening to the drummer last night, and he's moving along in this lyrical way, and suddenly a change that is so dynamic, it's a violence in relation to the lyricism, see? It's a violence, and it's magnificent in how it raises your spirit. And dance is like that. It has these moments and it really just grabs you up, just by the throat, you see? And then there's great transitions to flow again in a gentle way, and it'll grab you again. The music, and that's what we mean by, that's what I mean by violence. And then, of course, the actual subject matter will frequently be violent in description, but the real violence is the way the piece gathers itself suddenly and shakes you out of a stupor. A good example is one of the symphonies by Haydn, where he had a drum roll to make sure that the audience didn't go to sleep.
Surprise.
Bam!
Yeah.
So it's a violence. That's the
symphony,
exactly,
so-called. Yeah. And one other association, which is your association, or one of your favorite paintings in the National Gallery, is
that's
the Laocoon from El Greco. Ooh. Again, another frieze of figures in extraordinary activity and relationship with
and
landscape.
Reality. And see, that's a strange world that he makes. He gives you a lot of references, but you are entering into a reality that has little to do with the subject matter in terms of, now think about this, we know the story of Lockerwan, if you know, you went to school, fine, if you don't. What I'm saying is you don't need to know the story, but it's obviously Twilight Zone. There's no doubt about it. Do you understand what I mean by it? It's a world. However, whatever he uses, whatever myth, he takes you into a world. He takes you out of your particular world. And by all this shaping of these forms, the extraordinary shaping and tying together and lyrical relationships and paintings and fields, you shift into a world of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. And you
can't resist it.
You were talking with me about the way the serpent there is being held up as a kind of framing device.
A little painting right there.
And then creates a separate little
exactly.
reality.
He does that a lot. He does that quite a bit where he sections off a piece and then he pulls it together. It's amazing how he makes all these what would be non sequitur, separate things, come together in a harmony. And then notice that these are paint people for real. Ain't nobody been like that, you know. In other words, it's not that he's just starting us. This is necessary for this world to happen, for this world, for we to enter this twilight zone. It has to do, if you look at this wonderful, what the hell is going on? This person got two heads right there. See who up there, right? Two heads. Where are the bodies? Look at the world. Look at all this can happen in this world. You accept it. He's that good that you enter into all these strange relationships. Look at this body that starts in the very foreground with the feet and leans all the way back to the foreground. Look at the arms. I mean, what a dance. You understand what I mean? He's elasticized. Well, a real body? No, paint people. No, painting. You can do this. And we buy it. That's how good he is. Mm-hmm. We buy the reality. Yeah. And then I think, personally, the color relationships, these are a little poor, you know, the film. But, well, it's the film, not the painting. The actual painting in the museum is really, I'm not, you know, it's here, this darks. But
it's the contrast is too high.
Too great, that's all I'm saying. But I learned a great deal. These are great paintings. And I'm talking about painting now, not art. This is a world that you can experience. It'll resonate you personally. You don't have to go to school. You have to have eyes and permit your eyes to get in front of your brain so that you can now step into this Star Wars. If you understand why I use that phrase, very important. I would like to say how much I appreciate that you, this place is filled, and I'm not used to, I really appreciate that you like to work.
Loud. Thank you for hearing this.
So, it's the David Letterman show.
He said,
I really want you to know, I really do, and it's.
He said he really appreciates that you like the work.
Right.
Just so, in case you missed that.
And it was the work. I appreciate you coming. I really do, and so. I just want them to know that. And there are people here, and I want them to know. I really am pleased that I know you. Now, there are people I don't know, obviously, but there are people here that I really know. And I'm pleased to see you. I really am. Because we work alone, and you're isolated. This is just the nature of work. I'm not talking romantic. It's,
louder.
Shit. So, you know, you work alone, so you don't get together much. When I see the people that I care for, and we are friends apart from the art stuff, it's pleasing. It really is. And so I appreciate it very much. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.